discussing the ideas, the challenges, and the technology of the crypto economy. This is a Crypto Economy Chat. All right, crew, welcome back to the Crypto Economy Podcast. We are going to jump into a crypto chat today with John Walpert. And I'll let him give a little bit of an introduction, but I spoke with him at a recent meetup, and he just had a lot of fun stuff to talk about. And he's the co-founder of IBM Blockchain and Hyperledger, and is now working with Ethereum. And has recently started with Consensus at building blockchain applications and exploring and just kind of going in every which way, like how can we use this technology? And I think you're going to like this discussion. He goes into a lot of fun stuff. So without further ado, let's hit our crypto chat with John Walpert. All right. We are hitting off our crypto chat with John Walpert today. John, how are you doing, good sir?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Yes, indeed. I'm excited to get started into this. Most of my audience is very Bitcoin-centric, so why don't we just head this off with an introduction as to who you are, what you're working on, and kind of your perspective on this.
Right on. I got involved in blockchain when I was at IBM, and I was on the founder team for Hyperledger, Hyperledger Fabric, and IBM Blockchain. But I wasn't, a cryptocurrency person, and still really am still not. As we were discussing before we started, I'm really a evolve the internet person. That's what I've been for most of my career, is either as an application or startup developer. I worked on building one of the first ride sharing companies. And so my interest is in, does the internet, or does the, what capabilities does the internet give me to do things that enhance, a user's experience without me having to build it from scratch. I mean, I remember back in 1992 or something, just before the web was something to use with any effectiveness, we had a team of mine to build a whole communications protocol for all these different sites for this company all over the country. And a couple years later, it would have just been, a few RPC calls, it would have been easy. So what is easy now that wasn't easy before? What will be is what's interesting to me. People asked me, in fact, I tweeted this the other day on at Jay Walpert, at Jay Walpert is my Twitter handle. And I said, people ask, are you an Ethereum person or a Hyperledger person? Because you worked on Hyperledger, but now you work for Joe Lubin and Consensus. And that's largely an Ethereum shop. And I say, well, I'm a stateful internet person. I don't really care about protocols, flags, brands. I think that the Hyperledger team did some really important, made some very big contributions in the area of distributed systems. I bet a couple people will get the Turing Award for some of that work. And some of that work is going to go into the stateful internet. But is it all going to be called Hyperledger? I don't know. It's sort of like saying, I don't know, some people will remember HyperCard. Kind of a sovereign application that looked like the internet, right? You could make cards and link them with, so you could click on a word and go to another card. And I had a lot of fun with that back in 89. right. And then standards came and you could just do that.
Yeah.
In fact, actually I'll say that HyperCard was a more enjoyable experience than the standard was. But you couldn't do anything except for this little sovereign application.
I don't think I've ever heard of HyperCard. That sounds like a fun tinker thing though, to kind of set up your own little internet protocol, essentially. Yeah.
Well, no, it just was a linking. Go look it up. There's I was doing this the other day, and there's a good Wikipedia entry on HyperCard. Apple put it out.
Really? I'll check that out. Let me put that in my notes here.
So I guess, you know, not to be snarky, and I don't really mean to be. I love my old team, and I love my new team, right? I'm all about love here. I'm not interested in who's fighting whom. And in fact, the reason I'm at Consensus is because for all the time that when Hyperledger and my team went away from using Ethereum working on Ethereum, because we thought we needed to make some different contributions that we can talk about on this call. I at least never on a good day, on a lucid day, I never saw this as, toothy competition. This is all open source work. So, often when we would see each other at conferences, I'd say to Joe Lubin, I'm like, if there's anything I can do to help you without hurting me, I'll do it. And we're not interested in, some kind of fight. We're interested in involving the internet. And we all have different ways that we're thinking about doing that. And sometimes you have to diverge to do that, because you'll distract everyone from an idea if you force a different idea on them in the wrong way in the same sandbox, right? So sometimes you have to fork a sandbox, right?
Yeah.
And that's what we've got. We got a whole bunch of different, hundreds, thousands of little sandboxes, and we're all figuring little different things out. And one of these days, or in fact, I think that's what's happening now, is we're going more towards a convergence epoch. So 2015 to now, there's a lot of divergence. I'd say that, 2015 is where things really started to kind of hit, and both in industry, I don't like to call it enterprise, but in industry, whether that's startups or big companies, people using it for work. That's when, things really started to cook, at least for me in my experience. Obviously, when I was running my last startup, Bitcoin was starting up at the same time, and I was kind of focused on ride sharing. So I missed the cryptocurrency wave at that time.
Is that what you were doing just before that? Yeah. Was working on the ride sharing stuff? Okay, yeah. Cool.
Yeah, 2008 till, the company still runs. So I was kind of focused on something else. By 2015, my old boss at IBM, one of the greatest bosses I've ever had, Jerry Cuomo, really good man. He called me up and he says, hey, Lewis, it's Clark. And I said, hey, what do you want, Jerry? I was working on Watson at the time. And he said, well, there's this thing called blockchain out there in the wilderness. We got to go find it. And I said, well, give me a ship and crew and I'll go look. He said, well, I got a canoe, two muskets, and a dog. I said, okay. And we got lucky, right? We just got lucky. And suddenly it was a wagon train, and now it's in a boom town, and now it's St. Louis, right? I mean, it's just crazy.
You mentioned something a minute ago, and I see it a lot in your feed, the stateful internet. Can you expand on that? Like, what exactly do you mean by the stateful internet when you say that?
I got a blog post or a Medium post coming out on this, which will.
Oh, good. Oh.
Next couple of days. The stateful internet to me is just my way of keeping focused on what really matters to me. Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to force anybody else to think this way either. But for me, it's very helpful to say, hey, the internet, it needs to evolve. We wanted it to have state certainly in 1993. We wanted it to have state, and I think before then as well. And state meaning, that you could hold data in roughly the same way that messaging is done in a decentralized way on the internet, right? The internet, we could quibble over how decentralized it is and whether the ICANN folks represent decentralization. I get it. But, messages, you could nuke half the thing and it still would work, right? Mm-hmm. So message passing is as decentralized a thing as I think humanity has ever come up with, maybe ever. I don't know. Somebody could call in and say that that's wrong, but I'm gonna stand on it for now. Glad to be wrong. I've made a whole career out of being wrong. I also say I'm useful because I have been every kind of stupid, so I can see it coming. I'm still exploring new forms of stupid. So it's not like I'm done finding stupid.
Oh, aren't we all?
Yeah, right. I guess my current form of stupid is thinking that that the internet represents a reasonably good instantiation of a decentralized regime for messaging, but not for data, right? And that is what led to largely centralized systems for applications, right? The obvious ones are like Facebook and stuff like that. But in general, if you want to have state, you need somebody to run a server with a database on it. And they're going to run that. They're going to control it. So the stateful internet is one where the data plane is at least as decentralized as the messaging plane. And there are different flavors of that, right? I mean, you can depending on use. Let me digress for a second. I think that there's a good story here about folks that were involved in the peer-to-peer quote unquote revolution. I was there for that. And, and it was very cool. Peer-to-peer DHTs, we like them. But once we kind of got used to it and got over our preciousness about peer-to-peer, they started being really useful. So now like EA games, there's a lot of peer-to-peer in a game like Guild Wars, for example, but it's not like they don't have servers in there too, because you got to punch through a firewall sometimes. I think when we come up with new tools, we think, well, that's the only legitimate tool. Of course, it's not, right? So full-on monster decentralization is very useful, but things that are less decentralized can be useful for certain aspects as well. What we really need is a protocol that lets them work together, regardless of what you're trying to do. So the stateful internet, to me, is not just simply one where we're using state. And of course, you could say that money is to that, right, to the stateful internet or to Bitcoin or to blockchain, as email was to the internet, to begin with, right? That's the first biggest and probably for most of history will be the largest killer app for that protocol, for that platform, for that substrate. So does that make sense?
Yeah, I think I'm following you there.
Okay, so in that, from that perspective, cryptocurrency is an application of the stateful internet.
Now, in that regard, because like I do a lot of reading and digging, kind of about like data constraints, and one of the most fascinating things to me about the kind of the idea of blockchain and particularly as it as a currency is the distribution of trust. Kind of what's your take on the trade-offs between like how much application is running in this, in this blockchain itself versus the benefits of trustlessness and kind of that the spectrum of decentralization that you get there?
Right. So let me read back so I make sure I understand.
Okay.
We're talking about what the level of decentralization that's appropriate. And, when we talk about statefulness, are we talking about, full trustlessness, permissionlessness, and that sort of thing, or something else?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So here's my point of view, and it's just mine. I believe in a world where, it's not that I believe in it. I want, as an application developer, I want my application to be able to look up and find you, and for me and you and me to do something very, very, very private. I will give you 3 cookies if you give me 4 donuts, right? I have a business rule. I have some logic, right? I have a code, a smart contract, if you will, that nobody else, because I'm giving this other person over there across the room fewer cookies than I'm going to give you. And in fact, I don't want them to know that I have cookies. I'm only giving them watermelons, right, or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, in the logic of my code are clues to the relationship between you and me that other people shouldn't know about. Even if you can obfuscate the parameters, right, which is largely what we talk about when we talk about ZK snarks or Starks or, you know, privacy solutions or zero cash. We're talking about obfuscating the attributes of transactions that everyone is still seeing. And yeah. We're not talking about obvious, the logic is still sitting there. The business logic, right? Smart contracts. Now, a smart contract that says Alice gives 50 to Bob, you can snark that, it's slow, but it'll work. But if our agreement is a complicated, a representation of a large part of a real contract, a B2B contract between you and me, that's like a lot of cases, a lot of ifs, thens, loops. That thing will never, ever complete using snarks, at least in a sort of a brute forcey sort of way, right? So, and you can kind of go up a stack, and we can get wonky here, and we can talk about where you could use snarks in a different way with regard to logic, but that's, we would have a lot longer call. The point is that the business logic, that logic between you and me, cookies for donuts, I don't want anybody else to know about the cookies and the donuts. But maybe, you know, at the conclusion of this business, this relationship between you and me, we have to move some cryptocurrency or some fiat currency or something, right?
Mm-hmm.
And by definition, if a bunch of people are holding that currency, then it is important that it is not just between you and me, that we have... Certainly in Bitcoin and in Ethereum, we have a way of doing that where we have a public permissionless, trustless protocol for moving tokens around, right? Bitcoin or Ether or whatever. So in that case, or an ERC or whatever. So here I have the interesting problem. I have a private thing I want to do just between you and me, peer-to-peer. Problem with that is if it's just your machine and my machine that interprets that code, there's no way to do consensus. Consensus won't even work on two nodes, right?
Yeah.
Need more. And even a small private network is not proof against tampering the way Ethereum or Bitcoin are proof against, relatively speaking, proof against tampering, right? So on the spectrum, if you're a security wonk, it's funny, the folks in our camp, in the Ethereum Bitcoin camp, we talk a lot about security in terms of tamper resistance. That is, nobody can tamper with the integrity of the ledger, right?
Yeah, yeah.
We're all very proud of that.
Yeah.
But you know what it's terrible at, which is the other side of security, is surveillance.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Okay. Now the private guys, a member of which I was, right? You know, in Hyperledger, the private network people are like, "Hey, we're really good at making sure nobody sees your data or anything about what's going on." But tell me that 10 companies in a private network, you know, that 9 of the 10 can't collude against the 10th, or that they can't get together and change history or prevent a censor transaction. Of course they can.
Yeah.
And history is replete with examples of it. So really, and in fact, if you want privacy, or if you want surveillance resistance, well, the best thing you can do right now in today's world is, you know, yeah, it's like an Oracle or Mongo database locked down by a firewall. And even that's not great, but I mean, it's the best there is, right? So if surveillance resistance is what you want a private database, not a private blockchain.
Mm-hmm.
If you want tamper resistance, you want a public blockchain, public permissionless, trustless, on something like proof of work or hybrid proof of stake, proof of work, or what have you. You don't need it. So right now in today's world, we have one or the other. You either get surveillance resistance or tamper resistance. And somewhere in the middle are these private blockchains, you know, blockchain as a services. And they have their utility too, right? Because they can argue for why a consortium of companies should get together and do things. And they can say, hey, none of us is in control, but all of us have control, right? Mm-hmm. And that can change the politics of getting a bunch of powerful companies that don't want to be a second class citizen to any one of them or a third party, right? So you could, you know, there's some utility in that. But in terms of security, they are neither the best at tamper resistance, nor because they're a small set, nor are they the best at surveillance resistance. Because now you've got a 10 company, you know, 10 nodes or 10 peers. You have a threat. You've increased the probability of somebody being able to hack into one of those nodes by 10. Mm-hmm. So, and see everything. They might not be able to tamper with it, but they can see it.
You've expanded your attack vector or your attack surface as opposed to,
Yeah. And, you know, if you're Sony Pictures and you don't want the North Koreans surveilling your entire stuff, you see the point, right?
Yeah. Yeah. You don't put it on 10 different servers. You lock it down on one. Much
better at locking down the one that you didn't lock down well enough.
Exactly.
Right. Anyway, so you see the point. Mm-hmm. Now, I think the near future, which is usually where I live, the near future is where we have the ability to, and oddly, in this world, you need a mainnet. You need a public, permissionless, a trustless, large global blockchain that is good at innovation to be the root chain. So that you can coordinate things like saying, all right, our very private thing that we're doing is going to pass parameters to this less private thing between a bunch of people. And then that's going to pass parameters to a public thing like, you know, the Ethereum mainnet. And, oh, by the way, the state of the public mainnet is also, a parameter for the state of this other function on this private thing, and ultimately back to our function, right? So now you have a deadlock problem, right?
Yeah.
You've got a big circle where our agreement is dependent upon input from elsewhere. And if you circle all the way around, that input from elsewhere is dependent upon the output of our agreement. So you've got deadlock problems. You've got race condition problems. You've got non-determinism. When you start talking about a stateful internet, which is lots of different state machines that work together in a decentralized way so that you and I can do something private that impacts something that's public and vice versa. Does that make sense? Long-winded.
No, yes. I'm completely with you there, at least I think.
Well, and unlike the internet and messaging, if you're going to do that with state, you have to have something like, metaphorically speaking, a timer or a way of, you know, doing some kind of forgiving locking or something where you can say, well, okay, none of us are going to complete until block X on this umpire ledger, right? Mm-hmm. And then you can get around some of these problems. So, and I think, and this is why I'm over on Ethereum side now, is that it's just a lot more interesting, fun, and open-ended for me to come up with really cool application ideas that I can do on Ethereum with, you know, that take advantage of token economics than I could with some of these private things. So everybody's doing something that's really useful, but for what I want to do right now, when Joe Lubin called and said, who's the founder of Consensus, and said, hey, you want to start companies on the new internet? I'm like, oh yeah, I do. and that's, you know, how can I say no to that, right?
Yeah.
So that's why I'm over here.
I was about to say, this was pretty recent that this all happened, right?
Yeah, September last year, a year ago, almost. And
was that with Hyperledger?
Well, I was with Hyperledger, and then now I'm with Consensus. And,
now you're with Consensus, okay.
The thing that would make me happier than anything is for all of us to be able to somehow one of these days become, you know, part of the same big open source team that's working on this stateful internet together in a little more of a coordinated way than we do today.
Yeah, it's definitely really all over the place right now. But like, I kind of share your vision that you went into earlier, that I think it's a good thing that we've diverged in so many different ways, because I'm kind of more of the mindset that we should try literally everything we can possibly think of and kind of see what survives after the dust settles. And like, even though like I do consider myself a Bitcoin maximalist, I'm just excited to see the whole thing split and diverge and define and see where it goes. That's why I'm open to, like, for instance, you talk about the stateful internet and how, if I get your explanation right, you're basically talking about like these tiers of degrees of trust between private blockchains, pseudo small conglomerate blockchains, and then out to the public blockchains.
Well, yeah, and I think a year from now, you or two maybe, it'll be absurd to talk about private or public networks.
Yeah.
We're just going to talk about the internet of transactions, and you're going to define the scope of a smart contract or define the scope of a transaction set atomically, right? So you'll be able to say this particular transaction or this particular agreement needs to be private here, and then pass parameter to this other thing that's not private, what have you. And I mean, you don't put up a different Apache web server to host a web or to run a web page that where you have user controls and versus the one that the public can see, right?
Yeah,
so you have to have an entirely different protocol or a different internet for those two things.
Mm-hmm.
You just configure your web page for what you needed to do. Well, we should be able to configure our smart contracts and such for what they need to be to do. And I think, but then we do need some things like I need to be able to find you. So I need to be able to have some kind of lookup or some Ethereum. I like ENS. It's pretty cool. Ethereum naming service. A really powerful tool there. So I imagine being able to let my application find you, create a session or a relationship between you and me that's private, and then go from there, right? So you have to have discoverability, and then you have to have a protocol I do like the word channel. So Hyperledger coined the word channels, and it means something more specific in the Hyperledger fabric construct. But I wish that if I were king of the world, I'm not, I would call out all these things channels, right? These peer-to-peer connections. And I just imagine Ethereum is a pretty good candidate as the root chain for billions of n-lateral peer-to-peer connections, bilateral, multilateral, all coordinating through things like Plasma or like Peter Robinson's idea of a side chain, which will be in my blog entry. These are all, we're all kind of progressing towards these things. And the Bitcoin folks might say, hey, wait a minute, that's not Ethereum, that's Bitcoin. And it's entirely possible. It's not my place to say.
Mm-hmm.
I will say this, that in open source, they who steal the best are the most virtuous. So in open source, stealing is a virtue.
Yeah.
And Jerry Cuomo taught me this, when you see somebody else doing something that's an alternative to what you're doing, you don't get defensive. You love them in. You put your arms around them. You say, hey, we're doing something in the same space. Let's work together. Right. Yeah. Or at least, hey, I love your ideas. I'm going to take them. I think Ethereum has been, if you think about it, all these token-based chains, they have a lot to lose if they get it wrong. So it's amazing how quickly these protocols get conservative, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Ethereum, I think, by any measure, has been admirable in its ability to stay ahead of that conservatism and stay focused on innovating and looking at other things and going, okay, well, hey, let's take a piece of that. Let's take a piece of this. Oh, Fabric. Well, you guys did a really interesting thing with MBCC there. Yeah, let's take a piece of that. So that's one way to get convergence, but, and I think that Ethereum's doing a good job there. And so I think that there are some attributes of Ethereum and its history that make it a good root chain candidate. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to be just one root chain, but, you know, as an application developer, I would find my life a lot easier if I only have to find you on one root chain, or if I only have to coordinate through one root chain, right?
Yeah, yeah. My only, because there's a lot about Ethereum that interests me. It's kind of a fundamental difference in the approach. Like I'm very much the embrace all projects kind of perspective. But Ethereum has that move fast and break things mentality. And with a lot of what I've been reading about syncing issues and problems with the Lightnode subnet, that is my only concern, because there's so much that is, I think, interesting and being explored with Ethereum. But I fear that there might be a disconnect at the very beginning of it, that you can't really undo the history of these things. You know, like if there's a bad trend in place, trying to reverse that, it's going to get out of control really quick. So there's been a lot of things that have worried me about Ethereum, but it hasn't kept me from being interested in following the projects. I mean, that's why I have you on. I think there's still a lot of really awesome stuff being built, but it worries me as the root chain in that context, is that if that is the public chain, like you said about the internet in general, that it's just a decentralized messaging protocol, you blow up half of it and it still runs. It worries me about the state of Ethereum in a couple of years if a number of problems that I think are increasing right now aren't sorted out. But as you say, you know, the people who steal the most win, or steal the best things win.
I was very careful there. I didn't say win. I said most virtuous.
Oh, most virtuous. Ah, I got you. No,
because winning isn't really the point in open source, is it?
Yeah, I hear you.
It's about truth and understanding and expanding the scope of knowledge, right? Mm-hmm. And working together to figure out what works and what doesn't work, as best as humans can, dispassionately. I mean, it's a human trait to fall in love with your babies, right? So, you know, we all get a little precious about our code bases. And for my part, I like nothing better than to refactor a good code base, right? So I throw code out for fun. And so, you know, I don't care about any of the code. I only care about the ideas and which of them work, which of them can work together. And you know, Ethereum could make a misstep. Any of these things can make a misstep. And then something better will come up and take its place, or it'll take a misstep and learn from it quickly and pivot into the learning and go forward from there, right? So my bet is on Ethereum right now. But if I knew the outcome of that, I would already be a lot richer than I am.
I got a question. I just kind of want your perspective on it, because I feel like I did not really get deeply into the open source community and just cryptography in general until Bitcoin and crypto just kind of opened me to how impactful it could be. It was just kind of a vague interest. Do you see, since you've been in this much longer than me, do you see kind of the explosion? Like, has it really been, like, is open source just 5 to 10 times bigger than it was 10 years ago? Or is that just the fact that I'm just getting here and I haven't been aware of the whole thing happening?
So the question is, you know, what is the, can take me through that one again.
What do you think just Bitcoin, Ethereum, cryptocurrency in general, and I guess blockchain, it has done for the open source development? Like, do you see this as there's 10 times more developers in the space and there's much more excitement and capital? Or is that just my imagination because I only got here when crypto showed up?
Yeah, I mean, it has expanded massively, although I think we have a long way to go. I keep on remembering, a year ago, I used to grouse that, hey, when I was on the Java team back in the latter half of the mid-90s, within a year or two, there were 2 million Java developers. Mm-hmm. We had to go from Java 1, the first Java 1 being a pretty small affair, to holding it at the Javits Center, right? In New York City. It was massive, 30,000 people or some crazy number. And you don't see that at a lot of the, I haven't seen anything like that in blockchain generally yet.
Okay.
There were a couple of years in a row where Consensus, the event in New York, was at the same hotel. And I'm like, well, okay, something's wrong here. We should have had at least 5 times bigger hotel by now. I think what I figured out is that there's a lot more fragmentation in this space right now, and that we're not really at 1993, which is what everybody says. We're at like 1979 or 72. If you're trying to compare to the internet, right? I mean, HTML is probably a ways off. It's not, I think that's where we're at. We're still figuring out how to connect stuff.
Yeah. I thought when you said that at the meetup, I thought that was particularly solid, because I think your example was that you had watched a speech like 3 years, basically the same essentially take on it, like 3 years after you'd listened to it the first time, and somehow we were still stuck in the exact same 1993 or 1995.
They were reading the same speech and they still had the same date. Like, well, something's wrong here. It's been 1993 for 3 years. So I think we're farther back. There's a lot to do.
Yeah, I think we're crazy.
I remember, I was at UC Berkeley in 1986, and you could telnet into Doe Library from my box-like Osborne-like PC. I would lug home to Michigan and for books, and that was the internet. We just called it telnetting, but and then what was it, 69, a couple of years after I was born, the first packet went from LA to Menlo Park. That was the start of it. So I think we've got a ways to go. We had email in the 80s and 70s, so I think there's a long way to go. In that vein, I mean, that's what I'm doing in Raleigh now. So I've got a really lucky job. I'm building an Imagineering team.
Yes, I want to hear all about this. Let's dig into this. Yeah, that's a good point to hit now.
Funny note on that. Disney uses the word Imagineering, and they trademark it for their domain. But the word Imagineering actually was coined by, it was coined back in the 1800s and then used a lot in the mid-century, 1900s, by Alcoa. So it's a more generalized term than just the Disney Imagineering team, which I've had the pleasure of speaking to a number of times, an amazing group. But Imagineering here at Consensus is just the act of saying, okay, well, we have so many ways of, Consensus's job is to build things so that more people are inspired and enabled to build more things on Ethereum, on a blockchain in general, or with. And I like that. That's the most succinct way I can describe the company. And it does that in many ways. It has a venture arm. It has a labs team that goes and ingests teams to build new companies that we're sort of a holding company for like 53 companies right now. And so we have all these different ways of doing this one mission, which is, we work with big companies. We have a solutions team, which I'm on. So we have lots of ways to inspire and enable more people to build more things. And a lot of that comes down to, if you're a new venture, you've got to build something that people want to use today or pretty soon. Otherwise, you're not going to be a venture very long, right? I've done that 3 or 4 times. It's amazing how quickly you can't be innovative because you have promised some people who gave you money that you're going to deliver something. So, and I've got a really, there's a really, really amazing team here in Raleigh who work for Consensus, the Kaleido team. And, you know, if I were betting on who's going to make more money, them or me, I'd say them. Because they're practical. They know what people want today, and they're going to go deliver that. Right. So they're building a pretty cool BaaS. So if a company needs to experiment into blockchain and work with some other companies on a consortium, they can, 8 minutes later, you've got a network up. And let's not, you know, I'm not going to quibble over, you know, whether that's the future of the internet or not. It doesn't matter. People need this and they're delivering it. I get a different job. My job is to do what I've been doing for the last couple of years, write what I call product reviews from the future or from the near future. That is, you know, plausible, you know, sort of, I use this device. Amazon does this with press releases. They say, we're not going to write the product until we write the press release. And I think that's a step in the right direction. But then a press release, you can really fool yourself when you write it into believing what you already wanted to do. Mm-hmm. Whereas a product review, if you do it properly, gives you a much more interesting palette, right? You can say, I'm going to write about what I didn't like about this imaginary experience.
Yeah. I'm
going to write about what I'm doing. I'm going to write about this other imaginary thing that is doing it better. And you know, so imagine like being Michael Arrington back, you know, in the early days of TechCrunch and writing about this product that doesn't exist yet or this service or experience. So we write those. And then we build some of them with a little team of really talented UI, UX developer, full stack developers, you know, who can tell a story in pictures, words, and code. And then we open source all that stuff to the community to say, hey, free idea. Go build it. Go rebuild it. Go build something different based on how it has inspired you to think differently. And it all comes down to this, you know, there's two ways to think about any new technology. One is as a hammer. And so, for example, I think the relational database was a hammer. We knew what the nail looked like. We needed a database system with relationals, relational database. And we built one and, you know, you can pretty much tell when you need to use it.
Mm-hmm.
The internet was different. It's more like a telescope, right? It's a tool, but it's a tool for seeing not existing problems so much as finding new problems, seeing the world in a different way that makes you realize that you have whole new problems to solve.
Gotcha.
And so Imagineering's job is to say, hey, what are the unexpected novel uses of blockchain or rather, you know, novel things that we weren't thinking about doing because solving that problem, nobody's thinking about solving it because they didn't see that they had a tool to do it. You know, you can't predict Uber in 1978.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. The new technology and landscape completely changes your perspective on both what is possible and what even is a problem that's solvable.
Right. So, I mean, like if you're exactly, what is the solvable, what you're expanding the range of what is solvable. You know, if you're a social economist or a person that's interested in incentive structures named Galileo, you've just got yourself a telescope because that's what blockchain really is, a high precision instrument for observing and instrumenting ways of creating incentives that would simply, and managing them, that would simply fall under their own weight if you had to use the traditional rails, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost like, hey, you know, there's, you know, we all have been working on this flat space, and now we look into the telescope and see that Venus is actually a planet and space is out there. And maybe we should be starting to think about space travel, right? Mm-hmm. Whole new problem set. That's what I think the stateful internet presents. And so our team is just a little team that's gets up every morning and goes to work with their best friends and you know, figures out, you know, comes up with an idea and tries to build it.
That sounds like so much fun. Are you loving it?
Sounds like a lot of fun, but it's kind of like show business sounds like fun.
And okay. So
actually, yeah. Show business. Some people actually like delivering a product and making it better and better. You know, and some people, it's kind of like, you know, maybe a lot of people can sing a song, but what if somebody forced you to sing a song every night? What if that's how you got paid? You know, and you know, that's, you have to really have a, you have to really dig doing that. So I think that while it sounds great to almost everybody I talk to about it, it will only be great for those people that really just are very habituated to liking the prospect of doing something different every day, as opposed to doing things differently or better every day. Right. So if you like delivering production stuff and having the pride of realizing that thousands of people are using it, that's different than what we do, which is hopefully, if we're on a good day, we inspire somebody else to build something that thousands of people use or millions of people use.
Yeah. Question, are you still expanding the team at this point, or y'all just kind of like, you've got your group and you're hunkering down and just churning out work at this point?
No, we're just spinning this up here. And so I'm in hot pursuit of talent. So I'm looking for UI UX people and full stack developers who are, I'll call it, sure-footed enough to make rapid choices about how we develop things that are going to be where when you put it into a GitHub repository, other developers will respect the work.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be good enough to see patterns, know how to use libraries in such a way that will deserve respect, but then not feel like you need to polish everything to perfection. Because the whole idea is rapidly getting this stuff out and saying, okay, here's a story. Here's something that can be done. Go make it better.
Interesting. Now, is consensus ever, like, is there any plans to flesh out any of these into some like serious long-term project, or is this strictly just a lab of just a playground of build stuff and open source it?
Well, it's kind of like, that's a good question. It's not really an either or, it's more of a nuanced thing. If we thought about what we're doing as that, if we thought about what we're doing too much in either of those cases, what you said, just a lab that's kind of just having fun versus, a team that's building things that are going to go production, you'd run into the weeds in either direction.
Yeah.
What it is you have to kind of peripherally, at any given moment, you need to be having fun.
Yeah.
But, have a little loose, tight grip saying, you know what, a real good day after we've had fun is if somebody turned this into a major thing.
Yeah. Yeah. In that regard, with like what you're kind of imagining now and maybe where you want to go, like, what do you think just in the overall ecosystem, whether it be Ethereum, Bitcoin, or just blockchain in a general sense, where is the most work needed that you think will bring, kind of take us to the next stage and, take us from sending just messages on the internet to email or, creating HTML? Like, where is that next step in your mind?
Well, I think the next step is definitely in tools and in scalability. So the stuff that Vitalik and also the gang over at on the Bitcoin side, some real talented guys over there. I used to love going to the Bitcoin and blockchain meetup in San Francisco when I lived there. I think all of us are worried about scalability.
Mm-hmm.
And privacy, and then I will add confidentiality, which is we talked about that earlier. Privacy being obfuscating attributes, confidentiality meaning what Richard Gendler Brown would have called: if you aren't party to the transaction, you never saw it.
Yeah.
Or if you're not party to this agreement, you don't see the logic of the agreement. So I think those three things together, they're related, in fact, right? And when you're working on confidentiality and you're thinking about Plasma, you're also thinking about scalability. So, gotcha. So the baseline, layer one, layer two, the protocols need to come forward. I think we have some years ahead of us on that. And then, of course, tools. Making it easier to do these things. And then I have no idea what the HTML of blockchain looks like.
You can't give me a heads up on that? You don't already have that in your back pocket over there?
Probably not going to look like markup. It's going to be but it'll be the thing that kind of makes it tractable for lots of people in a way that it isn't today.
Yeah.
And then, of course, I think the other problem is identity. In a world where everybody had self-sovereign identity already done, and we'd solved what I call the God problem of identity, which is, who created the universe? Well, God did. Well, who created God? Well, this other God. You can recursively go through that loop forever, right? Who's going to secure my identity? Well, this thing. Well, what's securing that? Well, this other thing. So identity is really hard. And what we need is an identity system that everybody is very confident nobody's hacking into. Everybody's very confident that that if something went wrong, they would be able to recover themselves, but nobody else can use that recovery system to get into their thing. I mean, that's supremely difficult stuff, and lots of different teams working on different approaches to it. Once we bake that out, and I can say to, that, and I'm confident as an application developer that all I have to do is jack into this, I can make these two calls and I'm done. And identity and my application will know what it's supposed to know, transact with your identity vault. And so that you have a record of the fact that you gave me permission to do these two things, and that, you gave me, that I have an attestation that you're, who you need to be, but I don't actually know any data about you, right? I know that you have an attestation that you're allowed to buy alcohol, but I don't know your actual age.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah. See, identity is such an interesting thing because I feel like there have been a number of attempts at it, but it seems like such a huge bootstrapping problem because, kind of like you said, like with an identity system that's already decentralized and widely used, that already kind of has that network effect, there's so much you can build with that and add to it, particularly if we've already kind of figured out the privacy problem in addition to it. But before that, how do you get people to care about it?
Yeah.
How
do you get people? I wish somebody would build I don't want to have to use Google or Facebook for my OAuth. I want to use self-sovereign OAuth, right? That's the clicker I want. And I want email that where I can say, that the only email system I use is my email, and then I can ENS it to say, well, I'm also a member of Consensus, so my email identity vault and my identity vault and my email can share rules such that I can receive email that is sovereign to both Consensus and me. But I don't have to have two completely different repos.
Yeah.
Right. So that's an interesting thing. Right. So I think actually email may be in for a transformation here, or messaging.
Yeah, I hope so. Honestly, I'm in that same boat. Like I've been keeping my eye very close for a identity solution that is decentralized and truly has owner authentication and control. But even ones that I see that are promising, it's like, how do you get people to go there? Because it's such a, there is only a, despite the fact that you can give people, so many benefits and probably features that aren't possible in other ways with it, there's by itself, it's like most people don't care and don't think about that stuff.
And I'll leave you on this because I think we're at the top, right?
Oh yeah, we are. We're getting to that. Yeah.
I love this. Somebody at Google taught me this. Is that, at Google, there's a philosophy that says if that something that is not often used never gets used.
Yeah.
So, I think that identity solution isn't going to be an identity solution. It is going to be Trojan horsed in something that is addictive that we all use 10 times a day.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so I think the identity teams should, when we mature into the point where the best identity people are like, okay, I'm tired of identity, I'll go work for these other guys. And then they build identity into that thing.
Yeah.
That'll be I'd love to in fact, this is one of the Imagineering things we might do is I'm just calling it a diary. Wouldn't it be kind of cool to have a diary program like day one, only I don't have to worry that day one is holding on to all those secrets. I actually do journal every day and I'm terrified that somebody's going to hack my data. Right? And so there are things I don't say in that journal even.
Yeah.
Because I don't want that to come out. Right. But there, but we all as humans have things in our head. Right. Mm-hmm. And we want to vet them, but we don't want to ever have to suffer the consequences of somebody else reading it. So, an identity vault where, where I get my diary and then I'm very confident that the data is being sliced, diced, Julian fried, shamired, shamired secret sharing, such that 1,000 or hundreds of little shards of it or little pieces of it are scattered all over the place. And that the only way to even find the pieces and put them back together again is through kind of this recursive activity off of your private key. Well, then all you have to do then is make sure that private key is such that there's another thing I'd love to see, which is I call it gestalt identity, where you are the identity, right? And that once you have a private identity vault, you're comfortable, nobody can get into, no government can use, and it's decentralized both in the data storage and the access, then you can say, I'm gonna have my location pumped into it all the time. I'm gonna have the accelerometer data from the way my hand shakes the phone pumped into it all the time. And the hash of me keeps on changing minute to minute as my data changes. And now I have a system that can kind of know me because it knows where I am, who I am, what I'm all about, and it has like 25 vectors on me, and all of which have to match up in some probabilistic way. And then, of course, you get into the problem of probabilistic systems, and hashed systems are not very compatible. but you see the point, right? So if you have those two things, right? If you had a thing where you'd have to lose yourself to lose, and if you, and you also had a way of putting data, like, just journaling every day, right? And then you could say, well, hey, somebody's harassing me, but I'm not comfortable coming out about that right now. 10 years from now, you can produce those accounts, maybe some of the email you got, and maybe the pictures you're getting, maybe your account of what's happening to you. Mm-hmm. And this isn't just sexual harassment. It could be any kind of harassment or EOC violation. Whatever account it is, it's sure the accused could argue that you made a false report, but they can't argue that it happened when you said it did and that the data hasn't been tampered since. And that's really powerful. It's one of the simplest attributes of the blockchain.
Yeah, proof of history.
A powerful idea, right? Mm-hmm. A diary where you can attest to the fact that it's what you put in is when you put it in and that it hasn't been changed.
Yeah. Yeah, that's always been very early on. That always was a huge revolutionary idea to me because it not only does it not really exist even in the real world, like it comes with tons of caveats and levels of trust and knowledge limitations, but it definitely doesn't exist in the digital world. There's so many problems with that. And that idea of proof of history was so, so fascinating to me when I first learned about Bitcoin and blockchain in general. But with that, any other final notes? I've really loved this, and I want to keep digging into this. One question real quick, actually. You said you were going to read or write an article on Medium about the stateful internet. Mm-hmm. Would you mind if I read that on the podcast?
Sure. I'm hoping that my editor will release it soon.
Okay. Awesome. Awesome. Well, any final thoughts, grabs for Imagineers out there maybe?
If you're interested in doing that, contact me at Consensus. I'm pretty easy to find, or tweet me or message me on Twitter. It's JWOLPERT at Twitter.
Yeah, and I'll be sure to add all your details and link to your Twitter and all that good stuff on the show notes. Yeah, well, awesome. Thank you so much, John, for coming on the show. This was a blast. I really enjoyed it, man.
Right on. It was a pleasure. Thanks for the time.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, take it easy. All right. I hope you enjoyed that one. Do not forget to check out John Walpert and follow him on Twitter to make sure you keep up with all the cool stuff they're imagineering over at Consensus. That's at J Walpert, JWOLPERT on Twitter. I'll link to it in the show notes and tag him in the Twitter post as well. So y'all can check out all the stuff he's up to, and I'll also tweet out so that we don't miss his article on the Stateful Internet. That sounds exciting. I want to read that one. And until then, we will go ahead and close out today's episode. Do not forget to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. And if you would like to support the show, share it with all of your friends. Or if you want to send me a couple of bucks, I'll have my Bitcoin donation address and my Trezor affiliate link if you're trying to get around to finally getting your hardware wallet that you can store your Ethereum, your Bitcoin, and a whole slew of other cryptocurrencies and tokens and all kinds of stuff. They got a huge list now of crypto that you can keep safe on your Trezor hardware wallet. So I definitely encourage that, and it's a great way to send me a few bucks without actually any additional cost to you. All right, and I will catch everyone back here tomorrow with another episode of the Crypto Economy Podcast. Until then, take it easy, guys.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.